you very much. And thank you to Zeifmans for hosting, as well as for providing lunch, and to Steve, as well as to Reem for her help with registration, organizing, finding dates for it, and so on. I'm actually glad to see a full table. Reem emailed me that the partners were out on an international trip somewhere. Where are they?
Mexico.
Got it. Someplace warm. Okay. So I was a little bit worried that we would be short people, but nope. We have, thank God. It's good. I also want to introduce Rabbi Sammy Bergman, who is now part of my Beit Midrash. He's our Sgan. Those who remember Rabbi Ziering and Rabbi Abbey, so that's the position that Rabbi Bergman now occupies. And Rabbi Bergman is going to give the session next week. So he's here to watch you, but he's also he passed his CPA exams in the U.S. and actually worked for a while in the industry. So he brings to this not only knowledge of the rabbinic side of it, but also the accounting side. Please remember that everything I say today is neither financial advice nor legal advice nor stock. These are not halachic rulings. This is discussing issues. And if you have any questions, please make sure to consult whichever authority is appropriate for the particular situation, whether that is legal, CPA Ontario, or your rabbi, or some combination thereof. Please, if you could silence your phones, that would be helpful. The topics that we picked for this series, as we've been doing the last couple of years, are topics that are picked for credit relevance. In other words, CPA Ontario does not pre-approve sessions and say this gets credit, but they give guidelines for what sort of things should be covered, and that's how we chose the topics for the series. This is the first of three. And our topic, as you can see on your sheet, is dancing at two weddings, ? The ethics of moonlighting. Moonlighting meaning what? Quick definition?
Working for somebody else.
Right. Well, you have a main job, and then taking on side work. They meant to bring in, obviously, extra income, although we'll talk about some of the other benefits of this as well. Well, it can be related to, potentially, we'll talk about some of the issues that can come up when they are too closely related, conflict of interest issues, but it often is in the same industry, and that creates some challenges. So, if you take a look on your sheet at the first source, I found this article in Accounting Today by a fellow by the name of Edward Mendlowitz. Art of Accounting, Staff Who Moonlight During Tax Season. And this was a very happy, sunny look at how moonlighting works. He says, when I had my own practice and then became partners with others, I felt it was important for staff to be able to moonlight if they wanted to, but that they could not if I made them work more than two nights a week. I also felt the moonlighting made them better. He thought it was a good thing for them to be able to do so. For openers, they would make mistakes on their own time and had to figure out how to do a better job. That's not really a great, I think, outlook on your employees. Let them make mistakes, let them work for somebody else in order to do so. They also would get confidence dealing with clients, develop marketing skills, and be more diligent keeping up to date on tax law changes, become procedure-oriented, organize their time better, make sure they completed what was assigned to them so they didn't get stuck working longer hours and be late to a private appointment. So all of these are presented as reasons. I do not have more sheets. They're on the... Okay, thank you very much. So, again, this article presents that there are benefits to a firm when its employees engage in moonlighting. That can be a positive. But there are also pitfalls that come along with it. And the most obvious pitfall of moonlighting is that you aren't going to be able to do your main job well, for a variety of reasons. So that I found this article here in number two, having nothing to do with accounting, but having very much to do with moonlighting, at the time when we were looking at topics for this session, I came across this article from New York. More than a dozen MTA bus and train operators, MTA is the transit system in New York, so more than a dozen MTA bus and train operators were busted driving for hire vehicles like Ubers and Lyfts during mandated rest time between shifts, according to a series of 2018 investigations published by the agency's Inspector General on Wednesday. One moonlighting bus operator never once received the required 8 hours in a stretch of 3 shifts in January 2018, and sometimes had as little as 2.5 hours rest, the Inspector General found. So the people you are relying on to drive you safely on the bus, on the train, were actually not getting their rest time between shifts. They were using the rest time for operating taxis, basically. So sometimes the moonlighting will directly damage their work for the main job. Sometimes the damage is indirect. Take a look at the third source. Jonathan Zitz, this is a very good article. When moonlighting becomes your problem. The problem with the CPA moonlighting is that a practitioner is first and foremost thought of in his or her capacity as an employee of a firm. Right? In other words, if you work for Zeifman's LLP, then that's the way people look at you, even if you're doing some other job. What's the danger in that before you read the rest of the article?
If it doesn't work out, it reflects badly on the site.
Reputation can be an issue. What else?
Competition.
What do you mean?
Because you might be working for a company which does the same thing as mm-hmm. and you say, well, you know what, I'll go somewhere else.
Right.
You'd be bringing customers away from Zeifman's to elsewhere.
Right, you compete against your employer. There are a lot of schools that have practices that they block their teachers from taking tutoring gigs within the community because it will be seen as a way for people to avoid sending their children to this private school. I used to go to a barber who was working for one of these hairstylist places where they have 20 people, and at one point he gives me his phone number and says, you know, I can just come to you at night, and then I can, you know, take the entire pay myself. You end up with competition issues. There are reputation issues. There are competition issues. What else?
Compromise the employee's ability to perform his full-time job. He's working too many hours.
Right. So that goes back into the bus and train issue. It's going to damage directly the full-time job. What else? These are all true, but what else could be a problem?
Their availability is limited.
Right.
To work for their employer.
Right. And that, I think, you know, figures also into the direct harm. Take a look at this article where he points out something that I know I would not have thought of. He says, should problems arise, we're on the second line in number 3, should problems arise, forces adverse to the moonlighter will almost invariably look for a way to involve the firm, with its presumably greater financial strength backed up by insurance. Right? In other words, you work for Zeifman's, you do something on the side, and it goes bad. When you get sued, they're going to look to sue Zeifman's. Unless you say, well, I wasn't working for Zeifman's when I did this. Nearly any perceived connection can be enough to embroil the firm in a claim, whether as a party or as a non-party participant in discovery. It can just be a nuisance thing. They're going to subpoena all your papers and everything that you were ever involved with. This can lead to unanticipated and unplanned for exposure that might fall outside insurance coverage. And then he goes on to say that also your insurance company may feel that there was a misrepresentation because this wasn't mentioned when you applied for insurance. And if there's any financial tether between the practice and the outside venture, a loan to the practitioner that could be perceived as an investment, the firm stands closer to the flames than it would ever have anticipated. So there's a lot to unpack within this. But the dangers that we've mentioned so far, the pitfalls include harm to the reputation of the main employer, the competition with the main employer, legal vulnerability for the main employer, the fact that you're, again, not getting the rest that you need. I mean, it's clear why people would moonlight, right? Why would you do it?
More money.
More money, right. More money, interesting opportunities potentially. Often, if you're working in accounting, you don't even need to go looking for it because you're working for clients and they suggest opportunities in partnering with them. There are a lot of reasons to do it, but you create all sorts of problems in doing it. That's really the problem. I think we mentioned most of the vulnerabilities that I was thinking of. About the only vulnerability actually that we didn't mention is the problem of incompatibility between the firm's mission or the way they're positioned in the community and the work that you're going to do moonlighting. In other words, what if you're moonlighting for something that creates problems for the reputation of the firm? It's not something that they want to be involved with. So that could also be an issue. So what I want to talk about here are three questions. Number one, could outside commitments, moonlighting commitments, provide grounds for termination because you're not as committed to the employer as the employer expected? That's going to be question number one. What would people say? I'll ask. Could that be grounds for termination?
Not necessarily. It depends.
Yes.
Everything depends, but what does it depend on?
Well, the
employer. Factors here.
Back in the day, years ago, medical residents, and like interns and residents, they would moonlight like the ER whenever they could, just to get the extra income. And I think that the hospitals, they were interning, and they didn't care.
Okay.
I don't know what it is now, but that was common.
Right, but if the hospital or whatever it is, the business does care, can they actually terminate an employee for it? You were going to say?
It's in the contract.
Well, if your contract says that you're only supposed to be employed from 9 till 5, technically after 5 o'clock, you're not committed to your firm.
Right. If you have a non-competition clause, a well-worded contract can go a long way to clarify what you can and can't do and what will be grounds for termination. But if all contracts were worded well, then lawyers wouldn't have anything to do. The reality is that there are vague areas, and that's true from the standpoint of halakha also. A lot of this ends up being governed by industry norm. Just what is considered normal. And from a halachic perspective, that's true as well. I brought you source number 4 from the Shulchan Aruch, where we're told. The way I always do this, for those who haven't been here before, is that I always bring you the Hebrew also on the sheet, but I read out the English in the interests of time. So in a place where the practice is not to rise early and stay late, one who hires employees and tells them to rise early and stay late cannot coerce them even based on higher wages. This is because he didn't stipulate it when hiring them. If you hire him and say, this job requires that you get up at 4 a.m., then he has no complaint. He told him that before he took the job. But once he's taken the job, you can't change from whatever the norm is. Where the practice is to feed them, you have to feed them, to provide dried figs, dates, and the like. Provided. All is according to local practice. So that is going to be the governing norm in many situations, but what we're going to have to talk about is whether there are any rules that go with it on this front. But that's going to be our first question, can it be grounds for termination? Second, may one retain a moonlighter knowing that this may diminish her commitment to her current employer? Okay, flipping it, in other words. I want to get somebody to do some work for me, and I don't want to go through their business. Am I allowed, the barber that I mentioned, right? Am I allowed to retain that person knowing that it's going to make them less committed, less loyal to their normal employer? Is there any restriction on my ability to hire them? What would you say?
No
restriction. Why? If the law said do what's best for you, we'd have to change certain things. That doesn't always work. I'd have to do something about my car outside and where he throw my brick into it and take my wallet because that's what's best for him.
Aren't you allowed to get the cheapest possible? Like going to a mechanic on the side?
So we'll have to see. This is the second question. And then the third one is going to be a practical question. What can a firm do to reduce its exposure due to employee moonlighting? And I'm talking about the legal vulnerability that I mentioned before. Well, we'll see. We'll see. So what I'm going to do before we go into the sources and the issues is just pass around the sign-in sheets. Those who have been here before already know the drill. If you got the email advertising this that I sent out, you do not need to put your email address. It means that I already have it. But certainly if you want credit for being here, I need to be able to confirm you were here, so I need you to sign in. Also, if you want email notification about future sessions, then make sure that you're on here. And if you want email notification of other programs, not the Zeichman's ones, then check off the box in the third column. Okay. So, our first question. Can outside commitments provide grounds for termination? That's our question. So, from a secular perspective, the answer is maybe, as was said. Not in terms of CPA rules, but in terms of general employment rules. CPA Ontario only tells you what you see in number 5, which is the preamble for the most recent edition of the CPA Code of Professional Conduct. Members and firms are expected to be straightforward, honest, and fair dealing in all professional relationships. They're also expected to act diligently and in accordance with applicable technical and professional standards when providing professional services. Diligence includes the responsibility to act in respect of any professional service carefully, thoroughly, and on a timely basis. Okay. I mean, that's good. That's not grounds for firing if you're not diligent. But the take a look at number 6. This is from Fine Law Canada.
Sorry, just does that imply that a person who wants to moonlight has to inform their employer?
Why?
It says straightforward, honest, and fair dealing.
Well, only if it's going to impact them. Then yes, then you would have to inform them. If it's going to impact on them, then I would think that that would be required. Again, this is a statement of ethics, you know, and ideals. It's a preamble to a code of conduct. It's not a law. But take a look at number 6. Can I be fired for having a second job? So one of the questions that the author, Miriam Yosevich, asks is, does your second job impact your work performance at your daytime job? There is nothing specific in the law that forbids a person from working at 2 jobs. However, things become more problematic if a second job affects the job performance of a worker at their first job. Employers have the right to terminate their employee. They don't really mean that. They mean terminate the, you know, employee relationship. You can't terminate your employee. Please don't do that. Just edit. Like, you leave it in a vacuum, and who knows? It's on a recording. Employers have the right to terminate their employee if the employee's conduct and performance is not up to par. Okay, that's a harsh place to work. In other words, if the employee is frequently absent, late, or the employee's productivity suffers, then the employer has grounds for dismissal. Normally, warnings will precede the termination so that the employee has a chance to correct their behavior, and of course, that's very important. There has to be a paper trail, it has to be documented. But in the event that the moonlighting actually is affecting the quality of their work, that can become grounds for termination. The other point is the conflict issue, which is in the second part of number 6, is your daytime job in the same industry as your second job. This could be highly problematic in terms of your second job. If you work for a competitor in your second job, then it's likely there will be a conflict and your employer may terminate you. That's a separate consideration. So from a secular law perspective, the answer is actually relatively straightforward. If you can keep both balls in the air, right? You can do this job and you can do that job, and it's not affecting the quality of the work, and you're not competing, then, you know, and you avoid conflict of interest, obviously, then it's actually relatively straightforward. What about from a Jewish law perspective? So what Jewish law adds to this is, I think, something very important that applies to many professions, but in particular, as we're going to discuss, it applies to employer-employee relations. Jewish law tends to place relationships in a religious context. So that's true for personal relationships, and it's true for business relationships. Personal relationships, marriage. Right? It's not just a financial contract between the parties, but they get married with kiddushin, right? There's a religious ceremony involved. If they get divorced, it's via gerushin. There's a religious divorce. There are religious consequences to violating the relationship. It's not just a business agreement. It's also religious. Parents and children, right? Has a religious element to it. Where, if you imagine for yourself the 2 tablets, right, the 10 commandments, Aseret HaDibros, the first 5 are commonly understood to be between human beings and God. I am the Lord your God. Don't have any other gods besides me. Don't take my name in vain. Remember Shabbat. And then the second half are generally viewed as social mitzvot. Don't kill. Don't steal. Don't commit adultery. However, honoring one's parents is on the first half. It gives it a religious element. I'm hoping my kids listen to the recording. It's considered a function of one's relationship with God. Even business relationships like sales. When the Torah prohibits deception and it prohibits theft, and it places them in religious law as well as social, that tells you as well that that relationship has a religious element. And the same thing is true when you deal with employer-employee relations. The duty to each other is not only commercial, it's also religious. Can anyone prove that or disprove it before I get to the sources that I think prove it? Don't look ahead at the sources because then you can't answer the question. Can you prove either that it is or that it is not, Chaim?
The one from Yaakov with Laban, that we call Kofi, that you have to work 100%
of your effort. Good. So Chaim anticipates one piece that we're going to see, that indeed Yaakov works for his father-in-law, Laban, with all of his strength, but that doesn't prove that it's a religious relationship. That just proves that there was somebody who was a religious person who worked really hard. Right? How do you know that the relationship itself is fundamentally about your ties to God and not only about your ties to other people?
Why is it religious? Isn't it just basic human relations?
So what I'm suggesting is that it actually does have religious overtones to it as well. In other words, the way I treat my employer or the way I treat my employee is also a function of my relationship with God. It's not only about my my connection to the employer or employee.
Does it have, one would expect your employer in some case that you 100%. So if you don't, then you're stealing.
But I'm talking about the basic employer-employee relationship. Jeff?
I think there are specific things in the Torah that tell us not to delay paying a worker. So there are specific things that are set out in the commandments about how to treat workers.
True, but we're going to get even stronger than that. You're right, but we're going to build your point. Take a look on the sheet, please. Source number 7. Maimonides. First, we're going to talk about it from the employer side of things. So the very act of employment is interpreted by Maimonides, by the Rambam, as an act of tzedakah. It's an act of philanthropy. Just giving somebody work is a form of philanthropy. So that there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that says, "Yiyu aniyim b'nei ve'secha." Paupers should be members of your household. And most commentators, when they read that, say what that means is that you should welcome in the needy. But that's not what he says. What he says is, when you hire somebody to work in your household, take someone who is needy. Give them work as a function of tzedakah. So it makes employing somebody a fundamentally religious act. It's a mitzvah now. It's not just a commercial relationship. The stronger source, I like that one always. I would like to bring that. But the stronger source is number 8, where we go back to what Jeffrey mentioned in terms of the rules of paying people on time. And the Torah says, "You shall not cheat the wages of a worker who is indigent from among your brethren or from your stranger in your land at your gates. You shall pay him that day. The sun shall not set on him, for he is indigent, and for this he risks his life. He shall not call to God regarding you, in which case the sin would be upon you." And that's the phrase, that's the key phrase in all of this. It isn't just, although as you said, there is a rule of pay people on time, don't cheat them of their wages, but it's given a religious overtone by the end of the sentence, which says, and if you don't, he's going to call out to God, and that will be a sin against God now for your failure to treat the worker properly. So that from the employer side of things, the way one treats the employee is fundamentally also considered a function of, and it reflects on, the way one's relationship is with God. One more source for this is in source number 9. Rabbi Herschel Schachter, in his book Eretz HaTzvi, points this out. Actually, I'll take a second just to note, because I don't know if everybody here is aware, but our Beit Midrash has a weekly class that goes on Friday mornings, and it's advanced. It's all in Hebrew and not for everybody, but it's about what we're learning internally in our Beit Midrash at Yeshivat Or Chaim, and and this year our focus is actually employment law largely. It's a 6th chapter in Bava Metzia. It goes out 10:30 a.m. on Fridays. So if anyone's interested, I'll be glad to give you more information about it. But this is a source that we saw in that in the most recent session. Rabbi Herschel Schachter suggests that the obligation to pay someone who works for you is not about your financial arrangement. Take a look. He says, these authorities, who he's quoting, contend that the duty to pay an employee is not a function of a personal voluntary undertaking, but a financial duty placed upon the employer by the Torah to pay a worker fair value for the work done. This applies even if the employer does not agree and never obligates himself to do it. So he points out, for example, a source which indicates that if I have a field and somebody enters my field and works on it, I have an obligation to pay them. I never hired them. They didn't do anything wrong. They improved the field. I'm going to be expected to pay them. What I have to pay them, is it what they demand? Is it the market rate? That's its own discussion. But the very fact that I can have a duty to pay somebody without ever having agreed, there's no contract, nothing implied or anything, suggests that there is a basic obligation to pay people who work for you, and it's because the Torah says so, not because of an agreement between you and somebody else. Yes?
So you should pay the guy which volunteers to clean your windshield then too?
Yes, that's actually a big question. When I was learning to drive, it was in New York, and if you waited too long at a light, you knew someone was going to come in and clean your windshield for you. Right. But then you have the question of what if he does a bad job, which tended to be what happened. that's the question: is am I really obligated because he chose to do something that I never asked him to do? What if I wouldn't have hired someone to do that? Yeah, hi. So unpaid internships are indeed problematic for the Torah, for a separate point about slavery. The same reason that they're also, I think, illegal in much of the industry in Ontario, as I understand it. I heard about this from lawyers. I never looked into it, that there are issues with unpaid internships. They exist. They do exist. I know they exist because my son had one last summer. But yeah, there are issues with it. Yes?
But isn't unpaid internships training?
Well, that's the justification, is that something is being provided, resume item, training, and so forth. I don't want to get too far into that because it takes us afield. But my point here is that from the employer's side, this is a religious obligation towards the employee, and on the flip side, the moonlighter, the employee has a religious obligation. And this takes us to source number 10, which is really the main source for any discussion about moonlighting. A shepherd was herding animals on the bridge of the Papa River. One animal slipped and fell into the water. He, the shepherd, came before Rabbah, who said he was exempt from liability. Rabbah's the judge. He comes to Rabbah, and Rabbah says, you don't have to pay anything, saying, what should he have done? What could the shepherd do? He guarded as people normally do. This is what you do. You take the animals on the bridge, and you do the best you can. Abaye, who is the student of Rabbah, replied, then had he gone into the city, shouldn't say went, had he gone into the city at a time when people normally do, would he have been exempt? What if the reason why the animal slipped is because he said, you know, it's 4 o'clock, people normally take a break now. And so he wasn't there. Would he be exempt? And Rabbah says, yeah. What if he slept at a time when people normally take a nap? Would he also have been exempt? Yeah. So Abaye says, wait a minute. We've learned, how far must a paid guardian go in guarding? How far does the guardian have to go? To the point of what Chaim quoted before. Jacob says to his father Laban about the work that he did for him, I was consumed by withering heat during the day and frost at night. We've learned that that's how far you have to go if you're guarding somebody's property. To which Rabbah says, that's unique. That's talking about like a municipal guard. Somebody who has responsibility to the city. To which Abaye said, really, Jacob was a municipal guard? To which he says, well, maybe he promised Laban that he would do that, that he would guard that way. The passage in the Talmud floats the idea that a worker is obligated to work the way that Yaakov worked, the way Jacob worked. And the Chasam Sofer notes that we don't follow Rabbah's view. We follow Abaye's view as presented here, and therefore, indeed, your obligation as an employee is to match what Yaakov did, which is to work with all of your strength. The Rambam, Maimonides, brings that as halacha in source number 11. Just as an employer is warned not to steal the pay of a pauper and not to delay it, so the pauper is warned not to steal the work of the employer, wasting a little here, a little there, and so spending the entire day cleverly, meaning getting out of work. Rather, he must be precise with his time, for the sages were even careful not to recite the fourth blessing of the blessing after meals on an employer's time. In other words, historically, they didn't have work breaks. That didn't fly. You were working in the field, maybe you got a couple of minutes for lunch, and then you go back to work. So the Birkat HaMazon, the blessing after meals, has four core blessings. The first three are biblical. The fourth one is rabbinic. And the sages said, it's in the Gemara, it's the halacha, that you would only say the first three blessings. You wouldn't say the rabbinic one because you have a duty to your employer. So the fourth one, you have to skip. Today that doesn't apply because that's not the way breaks work today. And so that's different. But Maimonides is saying, if that's true, that they're forgiving the fourth blessing of the blessing after meals, how much more so that you can't just take breaks whenever you feel like it. I'm going to come to you 1 second, David. I just want to finish the line. He must also work with all of his energy. This is the key quote. For the righteous Jacob said, I worked for your father with all of my energy. And therefore Jacob was rewarded even in this world, as the verse says, that he became very, very great. His property excelled because he worked so hard. God rewards him.
Tip. I'm just suggesting that based on this comment from Abaye, that means Levite can't ever be permitted.
Yeah. He has to work with all of his strength. There's nothing left.
Because we have to go further than that.
So that's what it sounds like. Yeah.
Is there something special about referring to a pauper?
So the reason why the pauper is identified is because the biblical verse, which we quoted in number 8, framed the worker as the recipient of the benevolence of the employer by having that job. And therefore, it's like, don't cheat the pauper. That's the biblical verse that Maimonides is drawing on. That's why he uses that. Yes?
To me, this smacks a little bit of what used to be done in the Soviet Union when a worker would excel everybody who would make the hero of the city. And that became the standard for everybody on the board. Mm-hmm. I mean, our company has been doing this, and that's a good model, it's true, but I mean, we have to say, well, he did it, surely we all have to be exactly the same.
That's the debate between Rabba and Abaye. And Abaye is saying that's the standard. Maimonides, and not just Maimonides, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, brings this pretty much word for word as one's responsibility. Now, mind you, it will be limited by your agreement. Meaning, we said you go by popular custom. So popular custom is that you work from X hour to Y hour, right? And you have allowances for a lunch break. You're allowed to take personal calls or whatever it is. Then what Yaakov did is not germane. The popular custom is still going to convey to the worker certain rights. But where those rights end, you have to be careful. I can take Cheryl's question and then go further because there's a lot to talk about.
If the employer is not paying a fair wage, let's say you hired illegal aliens or you have maybe color wives in Israel at call centers and they're getting paid less than their counterparts in America.
Yeah.
And like there was an article about that. So, they were told, why don't you quit? Well, I need the money. Whatever I'm getting, I need it. So, does an employee still have to give 100%? If they're not getting a
fair. Right. So there actually is Talmudic discussion about whether you can determine expectations, read the mind, so to speak, of the employer based on their salary that they pay. If they pay you more, does that mean they were expecting more work? It was a little bit beyond the scope of what we were going to get into here, but there is such a discussion about mind reading based on the sum that is paid. I said I was going to go further. I apologize. But
then the only thing is, I think popular customs is a moving target.
Yes, it absolutely is. It's very subjective.
Yes.
Absolutely, culturally subjective. You bet. The other source that I wanted to show you on this in number 12 is that there's a midrash on that verse that we read before where we said that the employee is risking his life for the pay. That was part of an instruction to the employer, so you better pay him on time. However, it also implies that's what an employee is supposed to do. Expend all of his energy on the job. That's what this midrash sees here. So Much of this is also going to apply, you should realize, not only in a strict employer-employee relationship, but also in a business partnership. If I enter into a partnership with somebody and we say, you're going to do this and I'm going to do that, I have to make sure that I fulfill that part of it to the nth degree. We are effectively employing each other in that arrangement, which is why you have the following rules which would seem to inhibit moonlighting if the moonlighting could dilute your commitment to your main job. Take a look, please, at source number 13 from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. One who joins with another, you partner with somebody else, without specifying otherwise, should not deviate from local practice for that business. Just like we said before, local practice is very important. He should not go elsewhere, should not add partners in it, should not involve himself in other business. You're working for this person, so you don't bring in other partners on the investment or on this whatever partnership is, and you can't involve yourself in other partnerships. And if you take a look at number 14, and then I'm going to make a comment about both of these, if one sets up another person in a store to manage the business, such that they will split the profit, you have an investing partner and a managing partner. So he should not buy and sell other items with his own money. Okay, meaning you're managing the store for this partnership. You can't say, well, I'm also going to bring in this other stuff that I'm looking to sell for myself. If he does so, then half the proceeds go to the store owner, because now that's become part of your joint venture. Now, I want to stress here, as noted by the Shach, the classic commentary to the Code of Jewish Law, that assumes you can't pursue both. If you're able to pursue both, you honor your partnership fully, and you're also doing something else, then it's a different story. This is talking about where you're not able to pursue both. So we get an obligation here that you have to work the full time that you committed to, that you can't bring in other work that's going to distract you during the job, and take a look at number 15, you also have to make sure you're not too tired to work. He says, an employee may not perform work at night and hire himself out by day, right? So that you're working 24 hours. He may not starve himself or make himself suffer or give his own food to his children, for this will cause him not to do the employer's work, right? Now, the children situation, I don't know what to do with that one, but they feed your kids. But the concern here is that you weaken yourself and then you can't do the job. He weakens himself and so he cannot do the employer's work with energy. One is not allowed to engage in multitasking while working. Number 16, one may not engage in his own work while teaching. The person is supposed to be teaching. He's not allowed to do his own stuff at the same time. He's not allowed to stay up too late at night or increase his diet. The feeling is if he eats too much, he will not work well. I'm not so sure how that correlates. Anyone who deviates, meaning from the standard practice, has the lower hand and is removed. I brought you more sources, but I think this becomes clear at this point. I'm going to skip number 17. But number 18 is a contemporary writer on this topic. Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau was a judge in Israeli rabbinical courts with a particular expertise in these sorts of employment issues. He wrote this magisterial work, Pitchei Choshen, on all sorts of laws related to business. I've quoted it over the years here quite a bit. So he says in number 18, it appears that an actual employee certainly may not abandon his work and engage in other work, but not only in actual employment situation, he says, he goes on to say, not only actual employment, but also, step back. The case he's commenting on is the case of a teacher. And then he comments on the case of a tradesperson, someone who's working for someone in a trade, and then he says it applies to all employees, and then he writes, from here one may learn that one certainly must be careful when there is a conflict between the employer's work and his own work, like for a doctor of one institution to work for another institution or for himself, and the like. He doesn't want you taking on other jobs. Setting up a conflict of interest is certainly extremely problematic. So, what we're seeing here is that from a secular law perspective, yes, it can be grounds for losing one's job in the event that it takes away from your work for your boss. And halacha mirrors that with an added dimension because it's a religious obligation to work fully for the job that you have committed to. The question still is, within Jewish law, are there financial penalties for it? So that part is a little bit less clear. Rabbi Blau in number 19 argues that that if someone is working, he's just a little slow, you can't penalize him financially. For the fact that he's working slowly, and even if he's lazy, in terms of termination, we did see the line in number 16 that if somebody deviates from local practice, so his conduct unduly weakens him for work, then indeed he could lose his job. So this is pretty heavy, but that's the answer to our first question, Jeffrey.
So it's interesting. You have two sources. One source that shouldn't.
Yeah.
So in other words, you don't have the obligation to work for that not to have. It seems like there's an added obligation to get yourself physically fit where you're working.
I think so. I think that's exactly right. And I think that being fit reasonably requires that you maintain what is considered a normal diet. Their concern is if you go too much one way and too much the other way. Moderation often wins the day in these things.
Okay, I had a problem a few years ago that I had a cleaning lady which I got through a religious agency.
Yeah.
And after a few times when she came, she suggested to me, okay, I don't have to go through the agency, I just come like this. I didn't think that was right. It wasn't ethical.
Yeah.
So was I right not to do it, or was I wrong not to do it,
So that brings us to the very next area. Thank you so much. Are you allowed to hire somebody for a moonlighting role, knowing that it might damage their work for their regular employer? So obviously this question assumes we don't agree with Edward Mendelowitz, who talked about the wonders that moonlighting can do for an accounting firm, or it doesn't apply in that particular situation. So from a secular law perspective, I see no reason to prohibit. It may be unethical, maybe, but there's nothing that I can find in law that says you can't hire them. It's their job to make sure that they're being honest with their employer. But it's not. Yeah.
And you take them away. You're taking away one of their clients.
So from a secular perspective, that doesn't break the rules. It's their responsibility. We had a session here a few years ago on poaching employees and poaching clients as well. And it's pretty hard to run afoul of that in having conversations with somebody who's working for somebody else. Unless you're in like a sports league where there are tampering rules because of their unique partnerships. And even then apparently it happens. But when it comes to employment law, from what I understand, and if you have, Jerry, if you have something specific, I remember going through it at the time. Secular law doesn't seem to oppose it. Halacha does. In halacha, we penalize people who hire employees away from others. I brought you two sources from the Talmud for this, 20 and 21. The first one is the case that's called Ani Amahapich B'Charara. Rav Gidl was trying to acquire a certain plot of land. Rabbi Abba purchased it first. Rav Gidl complained to Rabbi Zera, who complained to Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha. Everybody's involved. Rav Yitzchak Nafcha asked Rabbi Abba, where a pauper is pursuing a cake and another one takes it from him, what is the law? And Rabbi Abba replied, he's called wicked. There are a lot of nuances in this source. There are a lot of things that have to be teased out to really discuss it at length. But the basic principle is that if somebody is pursuing something that he needs and is expending that effort, and it's not something that's easily replaced, you can't just run in and grab it from him. How much more so in our discussion, where they actually are not being pursued by the firm, they're hired by the firm. You're not stopping them from hiring somebody. You're not barging in on their negotiations. You're actually taking somebody who they have working for them and employing them for yourself in a way that is going to impede their work. I'm assuming that that's true. The other source that's relevant here is number 21. The Ani Menakeh Perosh Hazayit. A pauper is striking branches atop an olive tree. The way you do the olive harvest is you climb up in the tree, you bang against the branches, the olives fall down to the ground, and then you pick them up. So what happens if the pauper is up at the top of the tree? Once again, it's the pauper. He's up at the top of the tree, he's banging the branches, the olives fall down, some guy's walking past and says, "Hey, cool, olives." And he takes a bunch of them and leaves. So if the pauper is striking atop the olive tree, then taking that which is beneath him is theft. Why? Darkei Shalom. Because this is really bad for society. You're not going to have peace within society if everybody's worried someone else is trying to take stuff away from them. To which Rabbi Yossi says, no, this is actually bona fide theft. Because his act of knocking it out of the tree effectively acquires it on his behalf. Now, whether that's really full theft or not full theft is negotiable. But here, again, this fellow's working for the firm. How dare you effectively steal their employee's time from them? It is true, the employee is free to leave his work. Right? The employee can walk away, but then he has to walk away. Here, you're inviting the employee to come work for you while he's retaining his job for the working for the other. Ian?
Auction houses. Go ahead, attending an auction.
Yeah.
Referred to 20.
Oh, attending an auction. So I think it's different because there everybody knows what's going on. Meaning you're going to bid and you know there are other people who are going to bid. I think that's a given that that's acceptable. Otherwise, you'd have to just outlaw auctions. Time is short, so I want to make sure to get through the last question and then I'll take discussion with anyone who remains, but I want to make sure to get to the last point. But here, I think that you can talk to somebody who has a regular job about doing something on the side for you, but you have to make clear that they must clear it with their employer. If they don't clear it with their employer, you can't accept them to work for you. You're undermining the firm. By doing that, but again, you can't force them to. You just have to state clearly that that's your expectation. That's really all you're able to do. Okay. The last piece is just, so how do you protect yourself as an employer of people who moonlight? So obviously, making and enforcing rules, is the most important, but the article suggested something else in number 22. This article from the Pennsylvania CPA Journal says, the problem is not moonlighting per se. It is a healthy and certainly inevitable part of life in the CPA community. The focus from the standpoint of professional risk is that the lines must not be blurred between one's day job and one's outside ventures. To keep those lines straight and clear, firms should make and enforce rules about the use of firm property in connection with outside ventures. Right? Make sure that you don't write notes for the outside venture on your notepad that is from the firm. Also, firms should require that a communication in writing be on file with the outside venture describing the firm's relationship or lack thereof for the sake of clarity and managing expectations. Something brief and to the point, an anti-engagement letter should suffice, provided that it is backed up by compliance with the firm's guidelines for outside ventures. You follow? Just make it very clear. You always make life easier for yourself if you make things clear. I know the law firms have software for tracking conflicts of interest and the like. I don't know if accounting firms do also, but that's certainly a good idea. And from a halachic perspective, this all makes sense. The key being always to follow minhag, to follow local practice. Thank you very much. If you did not sign in, the opportunity is still here. The sheets are here, especially if you want credit or if you want notification of future classes. Next week, Rabbi Bergman, what's your topic?
The ethics of firing a client.
The ethics of firing a client. So that will be next week's session. Again, thank you very much to Zeifman's for hosting. I'll stick around for a few minutes in order to answer questions. If anyone wants to do a Birkat HaMazon with a mezuman for those who wait, please do. Thank you very much. Just one additional note. After the shiur, someone pointed out, and I think correctly, that in the case of hiring a moonlighter, there is an additional factor, which is lifnei iver / misayeya, the concern for making an offer to somebody to engage in moonlighting work, which could sabotage their employer, could well violate lifnei iver, putting a stumbling block in front of the blind, even if they're aware that it's wrong. And possibly misayeya, assisting them in wrongdoing, this requires its own discussion.